Welcome to the Weekly World Review, some of the best world updates from Al Jazeera English and other independent media sources. I'm your host and presenter, Skidmark Bob. Today we have reports from Iran, Iraq, Palestine, Somalia, Afghanistan, and an exclusive look into the Somali pirates. Also reports from World Refugee Day. We're going to start off most recent news on the protests of the Iranian elections. Stay tuned.
Around 3,000 people rallied in the capital, Tehran, despite a stern warning by the supreme leader to end the protests. It's not known how many people were injured, but there are reports that several people were killed. The defeated presidential candidate, Mir Hussein Mousavi, has reportedly said he's willing to sacrifice his life for the cause. The unrest began after President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad prevailed in the country's June 12th election, a vote many claim was rigged. Sebastian Walker reports.
Defying the orders of Iran's supreme leader, protesters took to the streets once again on Saturday. In what appear to be fresh images out of Tehran, a scattered crowd vents its anger as security forces attempt to disperse them. An official ban on independent reporting in the capital makes it almost impossible to verify exactly what's going on. But amateur video posted on the internet, like this footage of a female casualty apparently shot in the street, suggests authorities could be taking a tougher approach.
The events have become exhausting, bothersome, and intolerable. I want the protesters to take the police cautions seriously because we will definitely confront those who violate the rules seriously.
There was also another dramatic development.
A terrorist attack has hit the mausoleum of Imam Khomeini in the south of Tehran.
The reports of a suicide attack on Khomeini's shrine haven't been confirmed by other news outlets. The images show broken glass and what appears to be a body. Earlier in the day, Iran's top legislative body, the Guardian Council, said it was prepared to randomly recount up to 10% of ballots from last week's disputed vote.
Although there is no legal obligation, we're ready to recount 10% of all the ballot boxes around the country randomly with the presence of respected representatives of the candidates.
But it's unclear if that will be enough to end protests by supporters of reformist candidate Mir Hussein Mousavi, who on Saturday repeated his demand that the election results be annulled. Sebastian Walker, Al Jazeera.
The protest that was expected to take place in Tehran's Revolution Square on Saturday was not at all anything like the protests that we had seen in Tehran in the past few days. It was basically scattered groups of people trying to make their way through ranks of riot police and special forces towards the Revolution Square, and they were stopped on their way. And they were dispersed. Whoever tried to gather, they were dispersed. Later into the night, the gatherings were completely ended and quieted down. The people retreated to their homes. As far as we can hear, there were many slogans of Allahu Akbar, God is great, heard upon the rooftops. While the gathering was underway in Tehran streets, we were waiting for Mir Hussein Mousavi's statement to be published, which he says that people's motivation and their creativity will definitely find new ways of following their legitimate right. He refuses in his communique to take his complaint to the Guardian Council because he says the Guardian Council has proven that it's not neutral in its stance before, during, and after the election. He also encourages people to continue following their rightful demands, keeping in mind that it's a liberty given to them by the Constitution, and they should not forget about the principle of avoiding violence. At the end, it seems like Mir Hussein Mousavi is suggesting to the people that there should be a search for new ways of protesting, and he also encourages the government to allow to take to the streets and say what they want to say, encourages the government to hear the protests, the complaints, and let the whispers be heard before they turn into shouts. Alireza Ronaghi, Al Jazeera, Tehran.
Nazneen Mosheri now looks at the results of the worst 24 hours of violence so far in Iran's anti-government protests.
A young girl lies dying on a Tehran street. The film too disturbing to show in its original form. We don't know when it was taken and can't confirm its authenticity. It was uploaded onto YouTube. While there's been no fresh violence on Sunday, media organizations across the world have been flooded with footage from Saturday, like this film, showing clashes between demonstrators and the police. But it wasn't just the police involved. There were armed Basij militia on motorbikes. A voluntary paramilitary group, they carry guns and sticks. They only answer to the supreme leader. They have loyalty to no one else. Throughout the day, Iran state television has taken a very different slant on events. It says rioters and insurgents were responsible for this fire at a mosque. They're also reporting the people who died on Saturday were terrorists influenced by the West. At a press conference, President Ahmadinejad accused Washington and London of interfering in Iran's affairs. But key opposition figures are also speaking out. Former President Mohammad Khatami told an Iranian news agency, preventing people from expressing their demands through civil ways will have dangerous consequences. The immediate release of those arrested during protests can calm the situation in the country. And a dissident voice, Grand Ayatollah Montazeri, who lives in Qom, called for 3 days of mourning for protesters who've been killed. It's not clear where opposition leader Mir Hossein Mousavi is. It seems he may have issued a statement to websites on Sunday calling for the elections to be annulled. We can't verify it because his words have been pulled down. On the surface, the streets of Tehran appear calm, but the protesters' chants and slogans have been replaced with whispers about what's going to happen next. Nazneen Mosheri, Al Jazeera.
Iran's security forces have arrested 5 members of senior cleric Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani's family for their alleged involvement in the country's post-election violence.
This was the official announcement on Iranian television, confirming the arrest of family members of former President Hashemi Rafsanjani.
The detainees have been accused of provoking riots.
These are the pictures that appeared to have angered the authorities. Faiza Hashemi Rafsanjani addressing an opposition rally in Tehran last week. While the influential cleric has said nothing about the controversial presidential result, in the past he has made clear his dislike of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Before he voted in the election, he expressed concern it could be rigged.
In light of the recent events in this country and region, in my opinion, this is one of the most important elections this country has seen.
Rafsanjani was Iranian president from 1989 to 1997. He was close to Ayatollah Khomeini, the father of the Islamic Revolution. And when he tried to win a third term in 2005, he lost in a runoff with Ahmadinejad. During a televised debate in this campaign, the president accused his former rival of corruption. A furious Rafsanjani wrote an open letter to the country's supreme leader, urging him to take action.
If the system cannot or does not want to confront such ugly and sin-infected phenomena as insults, lies, and false allegations made in that debate, how can we consider ourselves followers of the sacred Islamic system?
Rafsanjani was conspicuously absent from Friday's address by Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei when he called for national unity. During the speech, he praised Rafsanjani for his role in the revolution, but admitted the pair have many differences of opinion. Rafsanjani is thought to be one of the world's richest men, a fortune built up through a family business. He also chairs the Assembly of Experts, which is made up of senior clerics who can elect and dismiss Iran's Supreme Leader. The arrest of family members shows the authorities will clamp down on any dissent, no matter where it comes from. Alan Fisher, Al Jazeera.
A reaction to the violence in Iran has come from across the world. In one of the latest responses, protesters have received a message of support from an unlikely source. Israeli President Shimon Peres has applauded the Islamic Republic's pro-reform protesters. He suggested the demonstrators could bring down their leaders.
Let the young people raise their voice for freedom, for a positive policy, let the Iranian women, who are a very courageous group of people, to voice their thirst for equality, for freedom, for fairness. And they really don't know what will disappear first, their enriched uranium or their poor government. Hopefully the poor government will disappear.
In Washington, demonstrators rallied outside the White House. Many wore green and waved signs showing support for Mir Hossein Mousavi. Iranian expatriates have held a series of rallies in cities across the United States this week to show solidarity with the demonstrators in Iran. Hundreds also turned out near Paris to show their support for Iran's reform movement and, like those in Washington, to protest the disputed election results. The rally was organized by the People's Mujahideen of Iran, a group which has long been at odds with Iran's government. And thousands have marched through the streets of Hamburg in Germany to protest against Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's victory. Chanting and waving placards, they were demanding a recount of the vote and for the rights of the Iranian people to be respected. But earlier I spoke to Patrick Basham, who's the director of the Democracy Institute, and I began by asking him about what do the protesters and reformists actually want in Iran.
No, this is very much about reform, not about revolution. I think the mistake in the West is to see this as a pro-democratic revolution. Rather than that, it's about the weariness and tiredness of the people of Iran, particularly younger and better educated people, who don't know why such a resource-rich country is doing so badly economically. They are frustrated and are tired of an incompetent government. It's not a religious issue. That's not the problem here. It's not about restoring a past type of regime or form of government. It's about better government. That's what this is really about. And the election has come together with what was a percolating desire for a different way of doing things, particularly on the economic front and I think on the cultural front. So it is about reform, it's not about revolution, which, as it turns out, makes it not an easier problem to solve, but a less difficult one to resolve.
Interesting that President Ahmadinejad and Foreign Minister Muttaqi have claimed once again that foreign powers are responsible for orchestrating these protests. David Miliband, the British Foreign Secretary, has rejected this claim. But let's be frank about this. I'm not so sure about the British, but in recent years, US officials have spoken of a preference for regime change in Iran. To what extent has there been Western influence in backing these dissident movements to try and trigger change within? And is there any evidence of that at play with these protesters?
There's no evidence that I'm aware of Western governments being involved in pushing regime change through the protest movement and the dissidents. However, I believe there is evidence of non-government players, particularly in the United States, being involved, at least indirectly. And what that is not something new. That's a continuation of where we were under George W. Bush's eight-year presidency, because, of course, the neoconservatives who got America into Iraq also wanted to take out the regime in Iran, and they, in government, worked actively to do that. And now, out of government, these individuals and their organizations and networks haven't changed their minds. They're simply attempting to achieve regime change through different instruments and in a less public way.
Now, away from the clashes in Tehran, many believe there is another battle going on, this one among the country's religious elite. Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has publicly backed Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, but at least one influential Ayatollah in the holy city of Qom believes the election was a sham and sympathizes with the opposition. Nicole Johnston has that story.
The city of Qom, home of Shia Islam and a center for religious scholarship. It's also home to powerful men, belonging to an 86-member elected body called the Assembly of Experts. While they play no role in the presidential electoral process, these clerics have the power to remove the supreme leader. And rumours of a split in the Assembly are rife. Over the last week, it's been reported that the head of the Assembly of Experts, former President Akbar Hashimi Rafsanjani, has been in Qom, rallying senior clerics to condemn the election. Iran's political process may be shaping up as a showdown between Ahmadinejad and Rafsanjani, and there are some staunch opponents of the government among the assembly.
They are waiting, they're bidding their time, and it indicates that Mr. Rafsanjani is working behind the scenes to make sure that the clerical support against Mr. Ahmadinejad's win would continue.
Grand Ayatollah Hussein Ali Montazeri, one of the country's most influential dissidents, says the election is a fraud.
Declaring results that no one in their right mind can believe, and despite all the evidence of crafted results, now they're attempting a purge, arresting intellectuals, political opponents and scientists.
Conservative cleric Ayatollah Mesbah Yazdi. He's the most powerful supporter of Ahmadinejad. But some analysts say Khamenei sees him as a threat and that Yazdi is positioning himself to become the next supreme leader. The political struggle between Ahmadinejad and Mousavi is one side of the crisis in Iran. The other is more nuanced, a power struggle among the religious clergy, jostling for the country's top position of supreme leader, and most importantly, the religious authority to steer the direction of Iran's Islamic Republic. Nicole Johnston, Al Jazeera.
Well, Iran has often had a fractious relationship with its neighbour Iraq since the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. Some Iraqis have claimed that Tehran has gained undue influence in their country. Al Jazeera's Hoda Abdelhamid reports from Erbil in northern Iraq on how some Iraqis are viewing the events across the border.
They fled the violence and came to the Kurdish north. A Sunni, a Shia and a Christian, former Baghdad residents who blame Iran for what they went through. And now they're watching with a degree of satisfaction as events unfold in Tehran and across the Islamic Republic.
I enjoy it. I hope it continues so they get a taste of what we've been living through. Maybe like this they will leave us alone and people can return to their homes and live in peace.
Iranian weapons come in from Kut, Basra and Diyala. It all comes from Iran.
The US did not act like that. It did not kill as much, it did not kidnap, and Iran did.
Political leaders are very much aware of the hostilities on the streets towards Iran. Perhaps that explains the muted reaction from Baghdad. Except for the president, no one has congratulated Mahmoud Ahmadinejad on his re-election, at least publicly. Ahead of key national elections set for the beginning of next year, no Iraqi leader wants to be seen too close to Tehran. Iraqis hammered home that message in provincial elections last January when Shia parties, traditionally linked to Iran, did badly, even in the Shia heartland of the country. The vote was seen as an indictment of a perceived Iranian policy to interfere in the internal affairs of Iraq. Many Iraqis still believe that the root cause of the turmoil and internal conflict in their country is Iran. Only through change in Iran itself can the situation in Iraq improve, they say.
I think Iraq will benefit the most if Ahmadinejad was ousted and the reformists came to power. Iraq has suffered greatly from Ahmadinejad's policies towards the Iraqi people. If he goes, the Iraqi people will have hope for renewal and a better life.
There is widespread fear that Iran's influence will become even more pronounced once American troops start to leave.
This is a very crucial year for Iraq. And if the United States, with Obama, will come up to its words and implement what they promise, that they will, for example, they withdrew from the towns, this means a big historical victory for American policy. That's why I think the Iranian government have an interest not to make this happen.
It's a real worry in a country still gripped by violence. Some hoping that domestic unrest in Iran will keep Tehran's policymakers focused on their own country. Hoda Abdelhamid, Al Jazeera, Erbil in northern Iraq.
Somalia's leaders say the country is in danger and has called for immediate international military help to battle Islamist fighters. Battles between the insurgents and government forces in recent days have left at least 30 people dead. There are reports Ethiopia has sent forces into the country, but it's not clear how many troops have entered Somalia or where along the border they might have crossed.
I said, you should now start thinking about coming home.
Zimbabwe's Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai was booed in London after pleading for exiles to return home. He was in the British capital as part of a European fundraising tour to help keep his country afloat. After 30 years of armed conflict, Burundi's oldest and last active rebel group is being demobilized. In April, the National Forces of Liberation, the FNL, agreed to lay down its arms and join the political mainstream of the small African country. Of its 21,000 fighters, only 8,500 will be officially recognized. They will be absorbed into the police and army. But for the thousands of other former fighters left behind, a return to civilian life is also a return to poverty, as Yvonne Ndege explains.
The price of peace, it's just $80. But to this former member of Burundi's last rebel group, it feels like $1 million. He's among thousands of men being demobilized in Burundi in an attempt to consolidate peace in this tiny African state following 30 years of on-off civil war.
These young Burundian men have just arrived at this government-run demobilization camp. They're going to receive basic supplies and a little bit of cash, and then they're on their own. It's not a permanent solution to Burundi's problems, but at least it's a beginning.
The goods are supposed to put them back on the path to civilian life. The FNL rebel group was formed in the 1980s by members of the Hutu ethnic group that were being persecuted by the then Tutsi-led former government. The subsequent ethnic fighting tore the country apart. The FNL and its members are now reforming and have become a political party, but there's a problem that could undo peace. Of the 21,000 former FNL associates and ex-combatants, only 3,500 have been integrated into the country's army and police force. These are among the men and women left out. Boredom and frustration is turning into anger. Indiscipline is rife. This baby was conceived and born in this camp where they live. They've been waiting for cash compensation for months. 24-year-old Martine joined the FNL at the tender age of 13. It was her dream to become a soldier. She believed in the FNL's pro-Hutu ideology, but now she's full of contempt after not being given the chance to join the police force or army.
We are living in extremely bad conditions. One, we do not have water. Two, we do not have medical care. Three, we do not have toilets. Four, we do not have clothing.
Foreign donors are funding the demobilization process, but they've limited the cash available, which begs the question as to whether they've approached this correctly. The former rebel and leader of the FNL is appealing for calm among former fighters.
Our fight was not aimed to get demobilized or to be only in this position or that position, but to see that the situation of all Burundians improve.
It's difficult to know how much of a threat those left out of the integration process are to peace. Elections are due next year. The hope is that they'll express any dissatisfaction through the ballot box and not with a gun. Yvonne Ndege, Al Jazeera, Bujumbura, Burundi.
The Taliban has attacked the main U.S. airbase in Afghanistan, killing at least two American troops and wounding six other people. The U.S. military says three rockets landed inside Bagram Air Base, which is around 50 kilometers north of the capital, Kabul. Attacks on the base are relatively unusual, as David Chater explains from Kabul.
The attack happened around about 2 a.m. local time this morning at the main air base and the biggest military base that the U.S. have here. Most of us have been through it at some time or other. Most of the American soldiers and coalition troops have been through it as well. It contains a very large airfield that's in use all the time for close air support. It's surrounded by large mountain ranges and flat desert. So it's very easy for anybody to approach with a mortar tube or with rockets and fire one in. But I mean, it's very rare, this sort of attack. And anywhere it lands, of course, it's, these mortar rounds would pose a danger because the base is crowded with troops all the time. So in a way, this is a warning to the Americans and to the coalition forces here that their main hub of operations inside this base, which is about 50 kilometers northeast of where I'm standing, can be reached, can be touched, can be attacked. So a worrying thing for the Americans and the coalition troops, because this is their main base of operation here in Afghanistan, and they can be reached.
Police have clashed with Israeli Druze who were protesting outside the Prime Minister's office in Jerusalem. Demonstrators are demanding to be paid overdue wages and calling for an end to what they say is discrimination against the Druze community. Israel's defense minister has told reporters that more needs to be done before a Palestinian state can be created. Ehud Barak made his comments after a meeting with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak in Cairo, aimed at reviving stalled negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians.
I told him about some Israeli consideration regarding to the abducted soldier, and basically said that I cannot have any new promises or statements because there is no actual negotiation running right now. There is a new team being nominated recently by our government, and they prepare themselves, and that when the time comes from them to start to work, I hope it will be far from the public eye in order to increase the chances that it will bear results. This issue of the abducted soldier could and should better treated far from the public eye. Of course, we expect Egypt quite naturally to take role. That's the only place where there is certain there is trust with us and certain influence leverage with the Hamas.
A powerful truck bomb has exploded in Iraq, killing at least 75 people. The attack happened near the northern city of Kirkuk. Children were among the dead. At least 185 people are said to be injured, and more than 30 houses have collapsed. Stephanie Decker has more.
Sirens on the streets of Taza, and a clear sign that once again, bloodshed has come to Iraq. A truck bomb went off near a mosque just after midday prayers. The force of the blast also destroyed at least 20 homes, a scene of total chaos.
It's the first time in 5 years such a big attack on an explosion has taken place in Taza town. The security responsibilities are still under U.S. control. There are fears among people of Kirkuk about the U.S. troops' withdrawal over the next few days because security is still an issue in Kirkuk.
Last week, another deadly attack, this time in southern Iraq. Dozens were killed when a car bomb struck a busy market in the Shia town of Bata. There's been a steady increase in violence over the last few months. It coincides with the pullout of U.S. troops from major towns and cities ahead of a June 30th deadline. Many people are worried that an already deteriorating security situation will get even worse. Kirkuk's Azadi Hospital is at breaking point as doctors rush to save the injured. Women and children are among the victims. Many caught up in a war they are too young to understand. Stephanie Decker, Al Jazeera.
Rescue workers and relatives are still picking through the rubble a day after a huge truck bombing in northern Iraq. At least 75 people were killed and 200 others injured in the blast in the town of Taza. It's one of the deadliest attacks this year and comes as U.S. troops pull out of towns and cities ahead of a June the 30th deadline. Musab Jassim reports.
Mourning the relatives they lost, the people of Taza have been hit hard. It was one of the deadliest attacks Iraq has seen this year. A truck packed with tons of explosives went off as people were heading out of a mosque, destroying buildings and dozens of lives.
The blast was very powerful. Almost 200 houses built over an area of more than 1 square kilometer were leveled to the ground. We've evacuated some 75 bodies so far, and the rescue teams are currently here to dig for others. There are a lot under the rubble.
The attack comes as U.S. troops continue to withdraw from major cities and towns. Under an agreement with the Iraqi government, they are supposed to be out by the end of this month. The withdrawal from only 140 of the U.S.'s 460 bases in Iraq is seen by many as symbolic. Nevertheless, many people are worried that an already failing security situation will now get even worse. The Iraqi government has condemned the attack and ordered an immediate investigation. But it will be little comfort for those seeking treatment in Kirkuk's hospitals, still struggling to cope with the hundreds injured in the blast. Mus'ab Jassim, Al Jazeera.
Tune to Free Radio Santa Cruz Weekly World Review here. My name is Skidmark Bob. We got more news coming up in just a moment. We got more stuff from Gaza. We hear about some rappers in Gaza telling their stories. Also, World Refugee Day and Pirates Haven from Somali Pirates. Right now, we're going to hear Street Sweeper Social Club with Mega Blast featuring Tom Morello and Boots Riley together as Street Sweeper Social Club. Stay tuned. Weekly World Review. Keep it locked.
Choose one, consider this game to go. Use some, stockbrokers pace the flow and do some. Stay with Leggio and Uber. Hey man, fuck them federales. Motherfuckers can't get enough bread at rallies. Bring a white girl through Mexicali. Homies came up and got dead in Alice. Cocaine, soda, and H2O. Tryna make the dough. Here's a hate below, but a statement dough. If we hustle for the stage to go, security breaks the dough. You can't take the blow of the mega players. To a faster rate. Think about bills and scratch to make. Motherfuckers work till the back is ache. But calculate what mass take. Revolution rock on acetate. And seeing how much our ass take. How much money can the bastards make? We gon' rass fake. Tell them pass the cake. Some get drunk on Jack and Bay. Yak in the back, come back and drink. Some just mentally masturbate. Won't graduate from class debates. .44 is to calibrate. But they'll replicate, we assassinate. Fuck big biz and the magistrates. Explode on the scene and smash the state. Mega blast. It's a mega blast. Mega, mega blast. Slum lords of the world have united. And they announced a world tour. You are hereby cordially invited to the Third World War. Slum lords of the world have united. And they announced a world tour. You are hereby cordially invited to the Third World War. Let's hit them with a mega blast.
Mega, mega blast.
It's a mega blast.
Mega, mega blast.
It's a mega blast.
Mega, mega blast.
It's a mega blast.
Well, the people of Gaza have faced a war and been besieged by Israel. So in an effort to express their grief and resilience, a group of rappers from the Gaza Strip are getting the word out, the only way they know how. Casey Kaufman has been to meet them.
Gaza, a place of destruction, but also creation. Ayman's been making music for years, but the recent Israeli war here has changed him. His music and his resolve. Ayman and Motaz call themselves the Palestinian rappers, and they record here in Gaza's best studio.
For our situation, it's professional, I said. Actually, we should invite one day Jay-Z or Eminem to rap here.
When Ayman isn't rapping about injustice and national pride, he's at university. He feels it's important to rap in his own language, but he's completing a degree in English.
To communicate with other people outside in Europe and in the United States, we need English.
Ayman's drive to bring his rap to the world has taken on a new dimension. His home was hit hard during the war, and that's when his life changed. His father took a direct hit and was killed.
This is my father. He got killed in this apartment. They threw four rockets, two of them, while we were inside. I tried to get out of my room. My father called us and he said, "No one get out, stay where you are." He finished his sentence, then they shot the other rocket. Then we couldn't hear anything from him. After that, he died. And I buried him with my brother. It is on the 16th of January, which is my birthday.
Ayman comes back often to his apartment to remember his father. And his memory now inspires his songwriting.
We used to smoke shisha over here. Here in this place, I can get the whole feelings, I can get the whole emotion in this song, because this song, I feel like it's something, it has to be perfect. I just want it to be perfect for him. Something from the son to the father. To his soul, not to him.
Ayman's father steered his children away from violence and towards education. His son, though, now wants to fight. And his weapons are his words.
فوق الصبر أنا صبرت صبر مش مخير أنا مجبر أرفض سلام. This means, after what happened here to my place and to my dad, it's not optional for me to refuse or accept the peace. I'm gonna refuse it no matter what. There's no peace with Israel. This is the thing that I got it from this war. There's no peace with Israel.
Ayman knows that he needs to get out of Gaza to promote his music. But until the borders open, he will keep on rapping from Gaza and hope that the world hears him. Casey Kaufman, Al Jazeera, Gaza.
The United Nations is marking World Refugee Day this Saturday to bring attention to the plight of millions of people displaced by war or persecution. The United Nations says 42 million people around the world were uprooted from their homes last year. Of those, 16 million are considered refugees or asylum seekers. They're the people who've left their countries to seek a better life. The other 26 million are internally displaced, forced to flee conflict zones. They remain homeless in their own country. The creation of the State of Israel in 1948 triggered an exodus of millions of Palestinian refugees across the Middle East. The 1967 war added to that number. Nisreen El Shamaleh visited a refugee camp in Al-Walid in Iraq near the border with Syria, where refugees live in hazardous conditions.
The community of refugees forced out of their homes in the Palestinian territories in 1948 found reasonable comfort in the Iraqi capital Baghdad, up until the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, when they became victims of persecution by Iraqi militias. With nowhere to go, the only home for them is Al-Walid camp near the Iraqi-Syrian borders. For Ramzi and her family, it was a case of fleeing death threats in Baghdad, only to face horrendous conditions here in the desert of Al-Anbar, as well as denial to enter any neighboring country.
I don't know where to start on our suffering. We're tired. We don't want food or water. We don't want anything. We just want out. I am one of the people here who has thought about committing suicide.
I asked her who she blames for this. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, she said.
I blame Abu Mazen. Why? Because he never paid any attention to us. He never even thought about sending any aid to us at the camp.
Abu Ramzi, her husband, had a different answer.
I blame the American occupation because all of our suffering came as a result of this occupation. Before that, we lived peacefully in our homes.
The environment of the camp is deadly. Sandstorms and temperatures of over 50 degrees Celsius have been recorded here. Desert winters are freezing cold and rainy. Drinkable water is not always available.
This is what we drink water out of. This is the situation here at the camp. This is garbage.
And ill women and children have died here because of poor health care.
Little has changed here since 2006. The situation remains as desperate as ever for the stateless Palestinians stranded in this barren and unforgiving desert.
Now, the only durable solution is resettlement in countries that would offer them asylum. Humanitarian organizations running the camp are working on this goal. That's why the tented accommodations have not been transformed into more solid structures, as that would encourage permanent settlement here, a matter that would horrify the refugees. But with the international community responding so slowly to these vulnerable people's demands, it seems their suffering will continue. Nisreen Shamaila, Al Jazeera, Al Waleed Palestinian Refugee Camp, Iraq.
As we saw in that report, many refugees seek shelter in countries near their own, but others travel much further afield to an entirely new way of life. Take Argentina, for example. The country has recently seen an increase in the number of people looking to make a new start, including more and more people from Africa. But as Teresa Bo reports from Buenos Aires, many of them face a new set of difficulties once they get there.
Praying is what makes Mustafa Lo feel closer to home. He came to Argentina from Senegal 1 year ago. He's an Arabic teacher who got tired of living in poverty, so he decided to search for a new life.
I'm making enough money to live decently and send money to my family. We chose Argentina because it's easier than going to Europe or the United States.
Mustafa is one of the thousands of Africans who have come to Argentina in the last years, a country that, unlike other parts of South America, does not have black people among the population. Most of the slaves that were brought here during colonial times died of yellow fever or were used to fight in the wars that have shaped this part of the world.
A person from the north that has never seen a black person before asked me if I was burned. Most people are nice to us, but others are not.
Most of them come alone, but get together to live as a community. They apply for a refugee status and try to stay as long as they can.
Most of the people that come from Africa end up living in old houses like this one, where they share a room with others that, just like them, cannot afford to live anywhere else.
There are no figures for how many Africans have arrived in the last years. They come from Senegal, the Ivory Coast, Nigeria, and other countries. Their presence is evident on the streets of Buenos Aires. Some are afraid of our cameras despite the government's generally permissive policies. They worry about being sent back to Africa. Father Santi Cervellin runs an organization that helps immigrants when they arrive here. He offers legal services and Spanish courses with the help of the United Nations.
Most of the Africans that come here don't even know where Argentina is. They just hide in a ship thinking they will go to Europe and end up here. There was a change in the law that makes it easier for them to stay. Many apply for refugee status.
And that's what happened to Peter Ofogebu, who hid in a ship in his country, Nigeria, and ended up here. He's now trying to learn Spanish and is hoping to stay.
I was not deciding to come. I entered in a boat for me to just escape from Nigeria because of the crisis in Nigeria. That is the reason why I decided to leave Nigeria.
Mustafa and the others like to celebrate their holidays as if they were back home. They cook traditional dishes and try to stay together in a country where they are a rarity. Most of them say that they won't stay here forever and that they dream of the day when they'll have enough money to go back home. Teresa Bo, Al Jazeera, Buenos Aires.
And you're listening to the Weekly World Review here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM, freakradio.org. Coming up next, we got a special first part series of called Pirate's Haven. It's an exclusive look inside the Somali pirate situation that's going on. So we're going to hear the first part today, and then next week we'll play part two. Now it's time for some Pirate's Haven here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM, unlicensed pirate radio since 1995.
I didn't like that one.
We've got breaking news now. We are learning the U.S. government is working to respond to the pirate attacks on Americans.
In recent months, Somali pirates have been capturing the headlines.
The largest ship ever seized by these pirates carrying $100 million of crude oil.
Forcing the world to focus on Somalia, a nation whose troubles are often ignored. But who are these young men who embark on these reckless missions? And what motivates them to carry out their audacious attacks?
They are capable of anything. If the world does not come up with a solution to tackle the issue, it will take a far worse turn.
Somalia, a peninsula dominating an important waterway, overlooking both the Gulf of Aden, leading to the Suez Canal, and the entrance of the Indian Ocean. A busy naval route that was once a center of commerce with the rest of the ancient world. Its strategic position enticed colonial powers to split the country, leaving the northern shore to be controlled by Britain. But this is also a land of nomadic people, embroiled in almost two decades of violence and famine. Since the Somalia government's collapse in 1991, the country of 10 million has not had a proper government. Unable to control its own capital, Mogadishu, anarchy flourished and has now spread to its territorial waters. For almost a generation, young men in Somalia have been raised by the law of the gun amid dwindling quantities of hope.
To speak only of piracy alone is an injustice to Somalis, because it's an illness, just as a high fever is a symptom of TB. Piracy is a result of a lack of government. The world has forgotten about Somalia. No support has been given to governments here. No genuine support.
Bosaso, the commercial center of the semi-autonomous state of Puntland. An important Somali port responsible for importing the essentials which the population depends upon. But the people of Puntland are also heavily reliant upon fishing for their subsistence. And conflict in the fishing industry was a direct precursor of the current problems.
Piracy began as a reaction to trawlers taking advantage of the lack of government in this country and scooping its resources. But when the trawlers armed themselves against the pirates, they turned their attention to commercial ships. And the huge ransoms they received created the free-for-all going on today. Many fishermen in Bosaso, I was told, were lured by the huge gains from piracy.
The local fishing industry has suffered at the hands of pirates. The owner of Las Coray Fish Factory once employed 1,500 people, but was forced to close down with the threat of foreign fleets mistaking their boats for pirates.
Lately, piracy has become a business. Fishermen took off and decided to join along. People from inland have now pursued piracy. It's a way to make money.
And compared to fishing, piracy is an extremely lucrative business. In 2008 alone, Somali pirates made profits of up to $80 million in ransom payments. And much of this cash has been moved inland.
Piracy is usually associated with coastal towns, but that is not the norm here in Somalia. This is Garowe, the capital of Puntland, and it is where most of those who finance the lucrative business have set a base and coordinate their activities from. They have chosen it for its central location.
We met a well-known pirate, Abdulrashid Ahmed, nicknamed Jock Rafi, flush from the profits of a recent hijacking. Abdulrashid claimed that he and his colleagues had just received a ransom payment of 1.3 million from a Greek ship captured in February.
We had the very fast modern boats, which made it easy for us to capture the ship. We chased it, and then we went on board while the ship was moving. We kept it hostage for 3 months.
Successful ventures like the one described by Jock Rafi help pay for future operations, leading to a self-financing local industry.
The way they are funded is that those who have been paid ransom sponsor the other ones. For example, if they're holding a ship and they are paid ransom and then another ship was captured, the first group will fund the second one. When preparing, about 4 or 5 men put some money together, and that's their starting funds. They might go the first time and come back with nothing, then a second time and a third time, and they could finally just go bust. It's also possible that they capture a ship in their first trip and then their funding becomes less expensive. They don't know where the ships are. They just go and search.
As piracy in Puntland has developed into an international issue, so pressure from within has grown for action to be taken. Abdulrahman Mohamed Mahmoud is the president of Puntland, and he took office in January on an anti-piracy platform.
People see the Somali youngsters with small boats hunting the big vessels, but they don't see who is behind that. They are not structured in such a way. They have an organization, a board of director, or someone who heading them and connecting them. They are linked in small groups to each other.
Fighting piracy is high on his agenda, with Coast Guard patrolling the waters. The challenge of monitoring more than 1 million square miles of ocean is daunting for such a fledgling and frail militia.
These men are Puntland's answer to the spiraling piracy on its waters, but they are ill-equipped and ill-trained to tackle the pirates, who not only have faster boats, but have also many times outgunned them.
Night patrols have been stepped up in the region's major cities. Soldiers stop and search all travelers looking for suspects that might fit the pirate's profile.
You can't differentiate in this town who's a pirate and who isn't. Some will tell you that they drive certain car models, but hundreds who work for the government drive the same kind of car. Are they pirates too? You can't identify them or fight them. And if you fight them, there will always be new ones coming from the nomads who'd go to the sea and hijack ships. And then you see them driving the latest cars.
Despite the huge challenges, the authorities have had some success in battling the buccaneers.
In this prison alone are more than 100 convicted pirates, but they don't consider themselves criminals. They say that they are Somalia's Coast Guard, men serving their nation.
When we were arrested, we were Somalia's Coast Guard. We took the responsibility to guard our coast from the foreigners who fish and dump waste in our waters. We had taken the responsibility to protect our sea since we don't have a central government. I had been forcibly detained, and I have been here for 1.5 years.
Facing a prevalent sense of hopelessness, the gains from a potentially massive returns can seem worthwhile to countless young men, no matter how great the threat is at sea.
There are many who are new to this that went into the sea and they got lost. They didn't know how to swim or do anything else. We feel very sad about this. Many youngsters have died in the sea and some have disappeared. Others had been killed. Others had been taken into foreign countries, and others are now facing trials in France and the US.
They are the youths of this country. They are young Somalis, unemployed, uneducated, and they are young men who have no hope. It is part of the bigger problem faced by Somalia.
And according to the president, the outside world could be doing much more to assist.
We have managed to capture them, particularly in the main centers. But we are unable to catch them along the coast because it needs more organization. We do know that some countries are genuine in the operation, but they have not focused properly how to tackle the problem. And there is a lot of speculation that some warships are protecting their own travelers, not hunting the pirates. That's the big speculation. We have suggested to the international community that the money they spent on high seas, on warships, if it is spent in fighting with cooperation with our government, would be more successful than what they are doing at the moment.
But critics say that Puntland's authorities are not doing enough either. And there are even suggestions that they are complicit in the trade, suggestions rejected by the president.
How we could be involved if we are against the ransom payment? We are against the ransom payment because we consider it is full effect. And this ransom payment not only hurts the international community and the owners and the people who are become hostages, but also has spoiled our traditional values, our religious values.
GP2WO bearing red 90 warning shots.
But with an impoverished population reliant upon any income that comes its way, it is perhaps little wonder that the pirates continue to be harbored within the community.
Tune to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM, freakradio.org, weekly world review here. My name is Skidmark Bob. That's about the last of our stories there. For more information, go to aljazeera.net/English or visit their YouTube page and you can actually watch these some of these stories here on Al Jazeera English. Great news source. Thanks for listening and tune in next week. 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock, weekly world review with Skidmark Bob.